honor to be introduced by you.
It's my honor to introduce.
It's my honor.
the boss. We heckle each other, it's fun. This is Dr. Josh Lotto. You'll have his fun accent, and you'll get to hear him narrating. He's an excellent narrator of videos as well. And I think you'll find his presentation lively and entertaining, because he's also a comedian as well as a physical limnologist. So let's give a warm welcome to Jeff Lotto.
It's very hard to follow up on an introduction like that. Now everybody's going to be disappointed.
I thought he was going to be funny. Okay,
it's going to be lively mainly because there's a lot of material and we're going to go through it quickly. So I'd rather go through it quickly and have some time later for your questions. Okay, so here we are. Tahoe Environmental Research Center, and here are just a few snapshots of what we do. Part of it is the education, we do research, we work with government agencies, and a whole range of things. Let me introduce you to UC Davis, because as docents, like it or not, you're part of the UC Davis family. And I think most of you should like it. So we're a large research university, 33,000 students, something approaching a quarter of a million living alumni from UC Davis in the world. We're first among national universities in numbers of papers in ecology and the environment. We think of ourselves as the water and the environment campus of the UC system. We're first among U.S. universities for soil science and environmental ecology programs. And I'm not going to read through all the rankings, but 7th, 8th, whatever, as far as public universities go, UC Davis has a lot to be proud of, and what I'm particularly proud of is that a lot of this strength is being brought to the Tahoe Basin, in part to be one of the players involved in doing the science for the restoration, but also a big part of that is what many of you are engaged in, or hopefully will be engaged in, and that's transferring that information to the public. Here we are, Tahoe Center for Environmental Sciences, jointly owned building, jointly housing Turk and Sierra Nevada College. So most of what you're going to be involved with are things like this. As I said, it's something sort of dear to my heart, really important. I'm not going to talk about that part of the program because Heather and her team are going to be indoctrinating you into that very well. What I will talk about, though, are these other things, the research we do. And one of the big things we try to do is to have this sort of quick link, this information superhighway between the research and the education. It's not really satisfying for us to do this research, to write it up in some prestigious journal and have seven people read it. It doesn't have a whole lot of impact, but we get 12,000 people every year through this year. And so if some of that research can be transferred into things that even a fraction of them take away or get inspired by, then it's very satisfying, not just for myself, but for all the staff and researchers here at Turk. Okay, so here we are at Lake Tahoe, as you all know, or soon will. Water flows out of Lake Tahoe, doesn't go to the Pacific Ocean, but it goes to Pyramid Lake. And this sort of pinkish color here, so it shows the Lake Tahoe watershed. It's kind of interesting because it's fused with this Carson River watershed, because water gets diverted and goes to the Newlands Irrigation District. So from a point of view, we generally talk about the Lake Tahoe watershed, but in reality, we're the headwaters of a much larger watershed, and one that actually feeds into yet another watershed. Okay, 11th deepest lake in the world, 500 meters deep. As Dave Antonucci pointed out, the lake surface area is a relatively large part of the watershed area, which really is one of the main reasons for its clarity. One of the Other things he mentioned was the large volume of the lake. Another way to think about that is something we call residence time. What that is the average amount of time a parcel of water would spend in the lake. So because of the small watershed, we get a little bit of inflow every year, huge volume of the lake. On average, water stays in Lake Tahoe for 650 years. So if you had to drain all the water out and let it refill, it would take centuries to refill. This is different than most other lakes or reservoirs. Typical reservoir, maybe 1 year or 2 years. Some lakes, maybe six or seven. This is hundreds of years. Okay, so let's talk about clarity. We've all seen this bumper sticker, Keep Tahoe Blue. The reason I talk about this first is that I know this is what a lot of people come in here wanting to know about. That's what they come to Tahoe about. So that's the Secchi disc. It was invented by my father, Angelo Secchi. It's strange, his name is on the Secchi disc. He was actually a radio astronomer. So a lot of these theories of the expanding universe can be directly attributed to his work. He started the Vatican Observatory. He was an eminent scientist for everything but measuring clarity of lakes. That's what his name is on. So I'm sure he's turning in his grave just thinking about it. So this is the famous Tahoe curve. Each of these white, what are they? Let's call them circles, discs. Represent the average for that year. You know, typically about 25 values. We take them following a very strict protocol. So it has to be good conditions. Today would be a great day because the water's calm, fairly blue skies. We take them within an hour or two of when the sun is directly overhead. We take them on the shady side of the boat. We always have the same person reading them. So it's not as if it's Heather one day and me another day and then the blind Steve over there on the third day. It's,
thanks, Jeff. You need to make that part of the presentation.
It's different. It's the same person every time, so there's consistency. We often do cross-checks where, let's say, our current reader, Brad Allen, would read it but not say what the result is, and then have somebody else read it, and it's invariably the same number or extremely close. So this is the trend we've seen over since 1968. And as Dave said, it used to be going up linearly, just going off and off. The last 10 years, there is this flattening off. That doesn't mean it's started improving, but certainly the rate of decline has leveled off. About 3 years ago, two, three years ago, we had one of the worst averages ever. So the higher it is, the lower the clarity. So this was about 65 feet. And everybody's blamed us, like, it's our fault. It's classic, sort of, let's shoot the messenger. But then the following year, it got better. But everybody was happy. They didn't throw money or accolades. The same way, great, keep up the good work. And then this last year, 2012, was better yet. What we tell people every time is don't stress out about an individual value. It gets worse this year or better the next year. It's the trend that matters. Because as you can see, there are periods way back when it got better for 5 or 6 years at a time, and then there are periods where it suddenly gets worse for 3 or 4 years. But the trend is good. We can break this down into summer and winter. And so what we see here is a winter Secchi disc. And here, we can actually say it is improving. And that's fantastic. We're the messengers, we're not doing the work to make this happen. But I believe a lot of the stormwater management work that has been done is what is contributing to that. When we showed this to TRPA, they were just thrilled. They said, yeah, we should get this out to the public. Then we showed them the summer one. And they said, well, people don't need to know about this. That's tell them about the winter. And as to why summer, the trend doesn't seem to be improving. It isn't flattening off. is something we're working on. I wish I could tell you exactly why. I don't know, this last year, we improved. I mean, 12 feet was the improvement. But again, focusing on that is the opposite of what I just told you, because it can just as easily jump back next year. All right. What's causing the decline in clarity? We're pretty convinced that it's very fine particles, tiny particles. And most of them are coming from this orange area here. This is the what we call the urban upland. It's where we live. It's from the roads, it's from our private property, it's from roofs, it's from shopping centers. And the reason it's the problem it is that before we had these impervious surfaces, surfaces where water won't sink into, the water won't go through asphalt or concrete. It'll just run over it and run over it quickly and carry particles. Before we put those roads there and our houses there, there was possibly a meadow. And when it rained or when the snow melted, it would percolate into the ground, soak into the ground, and the particles would be caught in amongst the soil particles and the roots. And so nature was keeping the lake clean. Now, we came in, built these roads, the same dust and stuff washing off the sides of the roads, get onto the roads, goes into a drain, the drain goes to a culvert, the culvert goes to the lake or a stream. And so we're short-circuiting. The good news is, we got to this problem by bad engineering, really. I'm an engineer, so I can say that. So the solution is maybe through good engineering, better engineering. But you can't do that overnight. It takes time. A lot of this is private property. But it will happen. A lot of it is also public property, and so agencies like Caltrans in California, or Nevada DOT, they can work on a faster time scale and start doing the things. There seems to be pretty general acceptance that it's the fine particles that have the major role in affecting clarity. Nutrients also play a part. Nutrients make sort of algae grow. They don't want you to go away saying nutrients are unimportant. They do play a role. They're particularly important in the near shore. All that slippery, slimy algae on the rocks is due to the nutrients. Okay, I said these are really fine particles. Let me go back. Less than 20 microns. How big is 20 microns? Well, that's what the next slide is here to show us. A million microns is about the size of a dog. Whoops. 3,000 microns is the size of the flea on the dog. The head of a pin is 2,000. The thickness of a hair, maybe 100. If you've ever changed the toner in a photocopier and gotten that stuff on your hand, that's what we're talking about. That's about 10 microns. So it's almost liquid. So fine, you don't see the individual particles. And E. coli bacteria are more like a micron. So this is, that's kind of the scale of what we're talking about. So 5-6 years ago, we would have said, I would have stood up here and said, it's particles, dust, and stuff like that. It's not the algae that's the major source of decline. And whenever I stand up and make a pronouncement like that, somewhere in the universe, a voice hears me and says, I'll show him. So what happened for a few years is nature, maybe it was nature, Mother Nature, think of fencing me, started producing algae that were much, much smaller than they had been. The algae in Tahoe used to be about 50 or 100 microns, thickness of a human hair. Suddenly they became about 5 microns. This little scale here is 2 microns. So this is a diatom, it's called Cyclotella. It's about 4 or 5 microns. And this is its silica, it's called frustule, it's like a skeleton. Suddenly nature started producing little particles that were just the same size that I said are the bad ones. So for about 3 years, nature started to become the dominant influence on clarity. I'm going to go back a few slides. I hope I don't confuse you. That was when, let me go back a few more. our clarity started doing this. When we had our worst clarity is when this particular tiny diatom was just there in numbers we'd never seen before, which told us it's not as clear as we thought. It isn't just the particles off the road, it can be nature as well. Okay, I'm just jumping forward now. Okay, we're there. Okay, that's the clarity story. Come back to it a bit later on. One of the things that I'm interested in, and one of the messages I'm always trying to get across, is lakes are extremely dynamic. They're always changing. You look out of Tahoe today, and it's flat calm. But he said it was dynamic and changing, but it's flat calm. I want to show you some results of some measurements that we took. This was a few years ago. We released something called drogue. So what a drogue is, think of a kite that you might fly in the air, but this is an underwater kite. And it's attached to a floating buoy. So this is what the buoy looks like, and under the water here there's a kite. So the currents in the water move this kite around. And what this tells us, in this buoy we have a little GPS, like you might have in your car or your phone, and it tells us where this drogue is being dragged. So what I'm going to show you now is where they go. So before I do that, this is going to go for about 4 days. And there's going to be a red one, a blue one, and a green one. And this is showing, you don't have to read this too carefully, this is just showing their speed, their velocity. So some of them, this blue one, for example, gets up to about 20 or 30 centimeters per second, a foot a second. This wasn't during any big storms. This is the wind speed, so this was just a normal set of summer days in July in 2008. Can you come a little with that map? Yeah. Okay, we'll do that too. Media not found. Okay, I'm not gonna. Let's go to the. That's all right. Let's try the next one. Okay, try doing it on this one. Okay, here you see it, three of them, red, blue, and green. And we're very curious about why we have invasive clams there. So it seems two of them just hang around this region of the lake. Did you notice the green one? It went clear across the lake in less than a day.
What are those?
These are these drogues. Like little worms. There are no worms in the lake. I'm going to show this again in a minute. So we have these three drogues, and these colors are just showing their positions. So this red one is still floating around. The time from when they were released, day 236, to day 241. So this has been about 5 days. So can you click on that again? Thank you, Allison. Okay, so they all start off together. You see two of them hang around Marble Bay. Just seem to get stuck there. Green guy takes off, goes off at about a foot a second across the lake. And interestingly, he sort of goes to the southwest corner, the general vicinity of Emerald Bay. We'll come back to that point in a minute. And then the others just keep hanging around here like they're trapped by maybe some circulation there. Okay. So those motions are things where we're interested in exploring, because those motions are telling us where things are going. If there's some pollutant introduced by a drain, it's going to be carried by these currents. If we have an invasive species, Asian clams, and they release their little larvae, it's these currents that may carry them to other parts of the lake. Okay, there are other ways we find out about motions, and some of this is from satellite measurements. So this is an example of an image of a NASA satellite, and what the image is the temperature of the very surface of the lake. So the red colors are the warmest, the blue is the coldest, and you actually see in this snapshot, we call them gyres there. You see another one here. we see something up there where it's turning around. So by we get these literally every day, every clear day. And so this is another way we look at motions in the lake. Okay. I hope this is the right one.
It should be.
Okay. I guess it's for some reason it's all stretched, so Tahoe is looking through a funny mirror. Saying. All right, this is what I'm going to What I'm going to show you now is not data. It's nothing we've measured. Doesn't mean we made it up, but it's from a model, from a computer model, a very big computer model, that takes all the accrued knowledge we have about the lake and makes a prediction of what things will, what's going to happen. So what this prediction is going to be of is where particles on the surface of the lake will go. So this is the lake, and we have in this quadrant red particles and blue particles and light blue and yellow. What the little green lines are sort of like, they're like a wind socket, just showing you the direction these particles are going to go. I'm going to show you this model result for 2.5 days. We're not going to sit here for 2.5 days. We're going to see 2.5 days of time at the lake. Now, when I saw this, I was stunned by just how much movement there is. I mean, to me, it was always beautiful. So what drives this model, what makes it work, is we input to it the wind. We measure wind at about 10 locations, and we put this into the model, and the wind isn't constant. It's changing direction, it's changing its intensity. Okay, let's hope this works. So a long introduction for nothing. So click in the middle there. Okay. This is a different one, you know? This is not the right one. It's not the right one.
You know what? It's online. I put it online.
Okay. Tomorrow, as part of the training, I order you to show the right one.
Do you want me to find it right now?
No.
I think we can open it.
Can you? Okay, let's try. You have the right introduction.
Quick question. When you say surface, how much depth are you talking about?
For this, it's maybe a foot below the surface.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
All right. Okay, so here it is. It's the same thing. Somehow it's distorted. We'll get you the right one. These are all moving up on the wrong place.
Yeah.
Anyway, when you finally do see it, it's shocking how something that starts off in the northwest in 2.5 days ends up in the southeast. So that's one thing, is just how much movement there is. The other that's green, is that it? Yeah, maybe try that one. Okay, this is it. And the other thing is, it's like it's breathing. It's just humping. And that's the wind, because the wind, it comes up in the afternoon and is strong and then it dies down at night. This is really, isn't that amazing? I think we should all give them we should give each of them t-shirts with our own. Do it again.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah,
it is. And so in the south, it goes this way, in the north, it goes that way, and down here, there's a separate one. Yes?
Can we look at that in real time at all? In now?
On the TARC website, there's a link to it. So you can watch it all weekend. Backwards and forwards. Yeah, that's it. So that's 2.5 days, and it takes, we can see,
42, 43, 44 hours. It's a dead zone around in certain little pockets.
Yeah, they just said there are some dead zones. Yeah, there are. And well, we think there are. One of the things I'd like to do this summer, we'll talk about it later, is we now have a lot more of those droves, of these little drifters, we have at one point I had the world's largest family plan with T-Mobile. Had 64. A family of 64 drifters, and we put them out on the lake and see what would happen. And what we like to do is put them in what these dead zones, in the nearshore, where people are, where the pollution comes in, and see what happens there. And what we're seeing here is what's happening in the middle of the lake, not what's happening where you swim. Okay, I'm being upstaged by a computer monitor. So let's move on. Okay, so. Invasive species. There's a huge issue in Tahoe now. It always, and it's not a new issue. It's just that awareness of it is new, mainly because the invasive species of concern now are invertebrates, aquatic. So here are just examples of some invasive species. These are quagga mussels. We do not have quagga mussels in Lake Tahoe, to my knowledge. And we would know pretty quickly because they attach to hard surfaces, and someone's going to report them. This is actually a tennis shoe that they found in Lake Mead, covered in quagga mussels. We do have Asian clams. These are just the shells from dead clams. And this is Zygnema. It's an alga that grows in association with them, which is part of the problem. So this is taken just down in Marla Bay. Fish, we've had invasive fish for maybe 20 years. And this is. This is hydrilla. We don't have hydrilla. It's a plant. It's rampant in the delta. We have other invasive plants, like Eurasian water milfoil, a huge problem. So most of our work has focused on, in the last few years anyway, focused on the Asian clam, Corbicula fuminea. And so this is about fingernail size. So they're tiny little things. They don't taste very good. I shouldn't say that. They're delicious. You should go out and taste them. Wonderful Christmas presents. Father's Day is coming up. So this is what Marla Bay looked like in 2008. This was, in the Truth in Advertising, this is probably the worst it's been. I mean, we presented this to some of the basin executives and the management agencies saying, do you want this everywhere? Thinking that we could get this everywhere, we haven't had it as bad since. And again, we're not sure why it was so bad in 2008 and not as bad. So the clams are there, the clams are still growing, but the green stuff, the algae, is what isn't as prevalent. This is what the bottom of Tahoe looks like in many places, as it should. This is what it looks like with a large infestation of Asian clams. We've done lots of research trying to understand where they are. This is a submarine that took pictures of the bottom looking for clam shells, and it went all the way around Lake Tahoe. And we developed a way of killing them, basically. We started off experimenting with these 10-foot by 10-foot barriers. The idea is you put this plastic barrier down, and it suffocates them. It's simple but effective. It also suffocates everything else there, so that's the downside. But we've done follow-up work, and it seems that once you clear that or level the playing field, the native species seem to be coming back sooner. But that's, we only have a couple of years of data, so we don't want to say that's absolutely the case. So we scaled up from there's 10 foot by 10 foot to this. This was a map that's about half an acre. It was down, we had one in Marla Bay on the Nevada side and one at somewhere on the California side. What you're looking at, the shoreline is sort of somewhere like here, and this transition there is just the edge of the shelf going off into blueness. This line of white, these are Asian clam shells. So there are numbers like 6,000 or 7,000 per square yard. I mean, huge numbers. This is the worst part. They're not everywhere in those numbers. Okay, Emerald Bay, nice part of the lake. There are Asian clams in Emerald Bay. How did they get there? Remember those little worms traveling across the lake? They went from Marla Bay over to the West Shore. And they didn't go straight through the entrance of Emerald Bay, but that was just a particular day when we had those out. What they showed is that in less than a day, larvae could get to Emerald Bay. And that's my theory anyway, not sticking to it. So Emerald Bay, state park, and was visited part of Lake Tahoe. So when we discovered numbers there, the numbers there are more like 100 per square yard, not the thousands per square yard. But it still struck a nerve with the management agencies, and they said, we need to get them out. Okay. So it's a very big project that's taking place now. Our role in it has been to fabricate rubber mats to cover 5 acres at the entrance to Emerald Bay. They hired professional divers to install them. We did part of the supervision of it, and we're doing the monitoring afterwards. So 5 acres were put down. For the complexity of the site and a lot of issues we didn't understand, it was decided that in addition to the laying out this rubber, we would also lay out underneath it like a material made of aspen. It's like shredded trees, if you will. Something that will break down, decompose in the 1 year that these would be there. And the reason we wanted to do that is as that aspen breaks down, it consumes oxygen. It helps drive the oxygen down. So here are these rolls of aspen. Here's the rolls of rubber. They're the professional divers rolling out the aspen, and then they roll the rubber on top of it. They have to come back and put rebar on top of the seams and zip tie it and make sure it all stays in place. And this is what it looks like when it's about half in place. So if you actually go to the lookout there at Emerald Bay and you look towards the entrance, you can see it. I've sent people there and they haven't noticed it because I haven't told them, so it's not such a hassle. Yeah.
What will the aspen do?
The aspen will decompose, it'll break down, and as it breaks down, it will consume oxygen. You have to get the whole point of it is not to keep them in the dark, it's to get the oxygen. Well, you laugh, but say if you try to get rid of Eurasian water milfoil, keeping them in the dark will do it. So that's. But for these guys, they're not afraid of the dark, it's the oxygen. So, yeah.
Had this been tried anyplace else, or did you guys just come up with this?
No, for the clams, yeah, we came up with it. It hasn't been tried. Lake George in New York had a similar problem, and they were interested, and we sent people over there, and they tried it. They did a really bad job, in my opinion, of putting them down, and so they didn't work as well for them as they've worked here. And they blame us for that. Yes. Okay, climate change. So Dr. Goldman's talking later this evening. A lot of what he's talking about will focus on climate change. So I'll go very quickly here. These are icicles on one of our shared buoys with NASA out in the lake. Okay, has climate change been observed at Tahoe? Yes, it has. This is air temperature. So maximum temperatures over the last 100 years. These are the minimum temperatures. So you can see there are ups and downs, but it's gotten warmer, especially the nighttime minima. What has this done to the watershed? The snowmelt timing. When the peak of the snowmelt, when the streams are running at their highest, back in the late 60s, it was occurring around the beginning of June. Now it's occurring 2 weeks earlier, around the middle of May, on average. I mean, this is weather. It changes year to year. So it's never going to be a steady decline or increase. What's it done to the lake? This is the average temperature over the lake since 1968, and it is going up. This is the surface water temperature over that same period, and it's typically going up. The last few years have been cooler, the surface temperature. But last, 2011 was warmer. I'm not sure what the 2000. Well, I know what the 2012 number is, but it's been at least not telling you. You get a lot of perks for being ghosted. Okay, so interestingly, if you, these are the temperatures at the surface, 0 meters, 10 meters, and 20 meters, all the way to 400 meters. And at the top, it's going up at about 0.23 degrees per decade. At the bottom, it's going up at 0.19 per decade. Is that point? It's hardly any difference, but it is a difference. It's real. What does that mean? This is the part of the talk where it could get really complicated, but I decided not to make it complicated. I'm going to make it, try to make it simple. We all know that when things get warmer, they get lighter, like a hot air balloon floats up. And it's the same with water. When you heat water, it gets lighter. So if the surface of the lake is getting warmer, then it's, that water is getting a little bit lighter. Water at the bottom is also getting warmer, but not as quickly. So it's getting lighter, but not as quickly. So the difference in the density between the bottom and the top is increasing. Okay, so if you need to mix that, and that's what the wind does every year, the wind in the cold in winter mixes the lake. As the density difference increases, it gets harder to do that. Okay, it's like when you try to push a beach ball down in a swimming pool. You've got to do a lot of work to push that ball of air into the water. It's the same, the wind has to do a lot of work to mix the lake. And as that density difference increases, it gets harder. So we've been able to put that concept into something called a stability index. And what this is showing is from the data, since the late 60s, this stability index has gone up, meaning the lake is harder and harder to mix. So it's increased 8% in 45 years. The length of time when it's harder to mix has also increased over this time, so it's increased 2 weeks. At this point, I'm sure half of you are wondering, why did I ever sign up for this? This is why you signed up for it, because this is actually really important. This isn't just important for Tahoe. I think this is important for every lake, every reservoir around the world. This is now a model result again. So we're back to the land of models, because we can't measure data in the future. So this is going from, say, the present time up to about 2100. And this is a computer model result. It's not reality. It's not, wouldn't even call it a prediction. That would be too bold. But it's giving us an idea of the trends. And so what we have here is this vertical axis is the depth of the lake from the surface down to the bottom. And what these colors represent is the amount of oxygen in the water. Oxygen is vital for fish and the well-being of the lake. So here we are, current days, we have lots of oxygen. It's all these blue colors, dark blue and light blue, lots of oxygen. Once we get to about a third of the way, two-thirds of the way through the century, there's lots of red. Oxygen is disappearing from the bottom of Lake Tahoe. Why is it disappearing? Because climate change, this difference in density is going to increase, and there's just not going to be enough wind energy to mix it. And so without the mixing, you don't get all that oxygen-rich water from the surface brought down to the bottom. Now, you may say, well, how do you know wind isn't going to change? Maybe it'll be windier, and this will be just irrelevant. Maybe. I mean, wind prediction of models of the future winds are really hard, and nobody has much confidence in them. But that could well be something that's happening. But the loss of oxygen here is something that's possible to happen, and if it does, there are lots of bad consequences. And this is actually one of the focuses of much of our research currently and probably for the next few years. Okay, so that's a little bit of how it works in life. What new and exciting things will we be doing next? When will they be coming to a science center near you? As I said at the beginning, we try. We really try to get the results of the science there. And with these new projects or new exhibits coming online, that's where you're going to see a lot of it. Now, again, I'm not trying to scare you and say there's going to be lots of new stuff, it's going to be confusing and you'll fail. Not at all. It's our job to make it easy for you and interesting and you wanting to present it. That's how I feel like maybe. That's Heather.
Wait, which one's me?
No. Okay. So this concept, it's a concept I've had for a while. It's the idea of an observatory, to have lots of things measured in and around the lake, and that data constantly coming in and presented in a way that everybody can see. And we tried to sell this to the National Science Foundation. They give us one of those, and two of those, and one of those. And they said, not this year. But since that time, and as you'll see in a minute, we've actually acquired many parts of this. We have a new fast boat. We have 6 buoys out on the lake, which you'll see in a minute. We borrowed one of these, it's called a glider. We've just installed one of these things, something that has instruments, that's got a cable to the shore, and then sending data to us. So let me show you some of these things. So the first of them is this real-time monitoring station at Homewood. So here we are at Homewood. What we have there is, and this literally went in 2 weeks ago, think of an anchor at the bottom of the lake, a vertical line with a buoy below the surface, and all the way along it, instruments to measure temperature at these fixed depths. And also at the very bottom, an instrument that will measure oxygen. This is 109 meters below the surface, a long way from the surface where all the air is. Every 30 seconds, data is collected, sent down the line, sent on the internet, and I get it on my phone. But I rarely answer my phone. So it's here. These are where our buoys are, and they have real-time weather data, a couple more buoys there, and these stars are where we have weather stations on people's property. So here it is, just a picture of it. There's the oxygen sensor and the temperature all the way to the surface and the line going to shore. So we installed this last week at Obex's marina. There were fabulous. They let us bring our line onto their property. They provide power for it. We're tapping into their Wi-Fi. So there's our little box. And here we are deploying the anchor and the instruments, and it was a fun day. Here are some more photos, and this is a photo from yesterday. So here's, it looks like it's just sitting there at the surface. It's actually about 4 meters below the surface, 2 buoys, and then a hook arrangement when we have to pull it up to service it. Okay, this is the exciting part, the beginning of the exciting part. This is data from, we have 16 of these temperatures loggers from the bottom, from the surface down to about 109 meters. And so this is from the 25th of May to the 7th of June. It's the 7th of June. So this is something I downloaded a few hours ago. The very surface at the top, it's getting warmer. Not surprising, it's been a few hot days. Okay, let's look at this one, this sort of purpley colored one. I don't even know if it's this one, but I'm not sure what depth it's at. So it's about 150 or 200 feet down. Okay, so this is a trace coming out of this instrument. This at the side is the temperature, 7 or 8 or 9 degrees. And look at this side. Goes up to 9 degrees, comes down to 6.5, up to 9. So it's sitting at the same point in the water. It's not moving. What's happening is this water is going up and down, probably 20 and 60, 70 feet at a time. So going back to what I was saying before, it's flat calm out there, but underneath the surface, 150 feet down, we've got these huge waves going by. What's the oxygen? I apologize, these are really rough plots and you can't see these things because this is just, we're still getting the output working. The red here is oxygen. And so this is data every 30 seconds for the last 2 weeks. Again, oxygen, it's, I would have thought beforehand that would have 350 feet below the surface, the oxygen would have was being pretty constant, maybe going down slowly over time. But it's fluctuating. The units that you may not be used to, it's micromoles of dissolved oxygen, study one of those to a milligram. But it's basically about 10% of the oxygen in the water is fluctuating there. And it's fluctuating partly because of these waves, but also, if you remember those drogues, those things floating around the surface, at the bottom of the lake, there's also motion. So patches of low oxygen water. Bottom line is, we don't know what's going on. Is that for you with confidence? Yeah. But it's interesting. And this is what we're going to be getting you, and it's your job to explain it. Any questions? Okay, very quickly, I need to wrap up. This is a glider. This is the thing we borrowed, and it looks just like the thing in that picture. So this was on loan from some colleagues at the Large Lakes Observatory, University of Minnesota. What this does, looks like a torpedo. Basically, well, let me show you a picture of what it does. We launch it here, and then for the next 16 days, it goes down and up and down and up and down and up. Across the lake, gets the other side, turns around, does the same, gets the other side, turns around. Not like staff. Busy tonight, no measurements. So as it's doing this, it's taking measurements of temperature, of the oxygen, of the algae, day and night. So we retrieved it about a week ago, we shipped it back to Minnesota. We don't have the data, it's still sitting on it, they're about to offload it. What we do have is some really rough data. Because to get the data off in real time, you have to use a satellite, and that's expensive. So what we did is we took every 10th data point off. What I'm showing you here is hours. So it takes about 16 hours to go across the lake. And so this is 45 hours of data. So this is about 2.5 trips across the lake. Goes across the lake, turns around, and goes across the lake. Let me break this down for you. This is like 2.5 trips across the lake. This is dissolved oxygen. So this is like a snapshot. If you were to sort of look across the lake and see what's happening over the top 140 meters, top 450 feet, the thing I want to focus you on, these colors represent different amounts of oxygen, is I'm going to trace the bottom of the light blue ones. You suddenly see it isn't uniform across. It's changing as we go across. Once again, why is that happening? Well, actually, I do know a little bit about why that's happening. It's these waves, it's these motions. We don't fully understand it. We'd like to be able to predict it. But this is a glimpse of the sort of data that we're going to be getting. Okay. These are my children. These are my 64. These are our new drifters. That's Alex Forrest. He's down in Australia now. And the idea is to put some of them out on the lake. This is their initial position. We deploy them like that. And then for the next 2.5 days, we could get... basically, they call into T-Mobile and say where they were every 30 seconds. The red ones meant that they'd lost contact at that instant, and the green ones were reporting. And so they would move all over the lake. Again, we're still working on getting that data for you. Final thing is, this, again, this is one of these buoys we have. This one looks different than the other because it has this arm and this pink buoy. On the, below that pink buoy are instruments that measure the sunlight that's coming up from within the lake. This only goes down about 30 feet, this mast. It has these instruments on. What's the importance of this? The importance of this is when we look at the lake and we see it's blue one day or gray the next, what we're seeing is reflected sunlight from inside the lake. And that's what these instruments are measuring. And so we're measuring every 15 minutes how that radiation is changing. And that's what one of the instruments looks like. Grant is cleaning. So, right now, this is where we are. Kikahu Blue. those instruments, again, they're reporting in real time, you want to record Tahoe's blueness. Rather than just saying the clarity of the Secchi depth is this, we want to be able to say, put a number on the blueness and see, is it really improving? The clarity may improve, but for some reason, we're starting to get different tone to the lake. And this is possible now. Okay. Thank you. This is Heather on a not so good day. Sincerely, we couldn't do it without you. The program we have here, you know, we cannot run with Heather and Free America. So thank you for volunteering, and we hope we can help you succeed, and you can help us succeed. I should add that Dr. Charles Goldman just entered. He normally comes in after my talks, but this time he...
Well, it's so embarrassing. Your slides are so much better than mine. I feel like a roadkill on the information highway. See, it's actually I borrowed two from my talk that follows after a bit.
Yes.
Now, since he's here, I'm just curious, because it appears that your research is migrating into climate change as well as keeping Tahoe blue. So it sounds like you're starting to move in, or moving in that direction more as a model for tracking the impact of climate change on the environment. Here.
It's an interesting observation. I think what we're all migrating to is, number one, not just looking at the lake as it's about the lake. It was thought of, first of all, as well, it's the watershed. It's what's happening in the watershed that's affecting the lake. And as I was talking to Larry earlier on, you know, there was a realization a lot of what happens comes from the air as well. So we have this airshed. We'd always assumed, and it was always the fact, you know, 50 years ago, the climate was wasn't changing much, so you could count on the stream flows on average being the same. With climate change now, that's not true. Flows 50 years from now are going to be totally different than they were the previous 50 years. So climate is just, it's a factor that's affecting the lake. And it's certainly, it's not our only focus. It's something like invasive species. Again, that's changing a lot of things in the lake. So we're looking at the big drivers of what's happening in the lake.
Thanks.
At the very back there.
2010 high mark you're pointing at, been the result of that winter, higher winter, more erosive effects into the lake? Does that play into it?
It's sort of been a few years since 2010. We looked at that, and it wasn't. It was actually, if I remember, what we think of as a 2010 winter would actually be affecting the 2011 clarity. So what I report as the 2010 clarity was really driven by 2009, which was a pretty average year. So, you know, we've always said in the past, the wet years, clarity will go down. But that year seemed to defy it, and that's where we started looking at the algae. Yes, ma'am.
With your Secchi disk measurements with clarity, you have one reader of them. Is there one location, or is it an average?
It's actually, we have two locations. One of them we measure every month, and the other one we measure about three times a month. We usually report the one where we do three times a month because we get more values there. We compare them, and they track really, really closely. So it is, you know, the trend wouldn't be like this on one and like that on the other.
Is it more in the middle or closer to shore?
The one we use is closer to shore. It's probably about, a mile or so off Homewood. But very close to the Midlake Station. Yes?
Why did you guys choose Homewood for...
Charles may want to add to this. In 1976, we bought a boat called the John LeCun. It's a fantastic boat, great work platform. I think the guys are scheduled to go out on it in July. One of the things you'll notice is this is a really slow boat, and we can't go very fast. So both of our locations are close to Tahoe City. because we could get to them in less than an hour. Now we have a faster boat as well, so we could have gone anywhere. Dr. Goldman did a study in, like in the 70s, where he measured a whole bunch of things at about 15 or 20 locations around the lake, and they were all different. He averaged them, and he found the location that was closest to the average, and that was the site at Homewood, you know, off Homewood. So I've stuck with it ever since. At the very back there.
Yeah, with the different locations, obviously the whole point of this was dynamic. I was curious whether you're doing anything with sort of aerial sensing and kind of looking at overall dissolved oxygen, those kinds of things, using kind of remote sensing methods, or what they got from it.
Yeah, we're doing a lot with remote sensing. I've got a postdoctoral scholar working with me, and that's all he does. What we're using it for, we've used it to try to look at, to measure clarity, but that's, we've had mixed results with that. Right now we're using it to try to look for invasive species and macrophytes and the like. And again, that is difficult too. A lot of remote sensing, the pixel size was quite large, which was a problem. Now it's getting smaller. Unfortunately, oxygen is something we can't measure, so we're looking for surrogates for oxygen. But anyway, that's the goal, is to be able to use our one site to calibrate the remote sensing and be able to say, yeah, we have a big picture of the whole thing. Yeah.
I'm sure there's fascinating circulation patterns. I'm wondering if there are any changes in those patterns as a function of seasonal wind direction and speed changes.
I'm sure there are, and I'm not sure what they are. What we'll be providing for you guys, and this is sort of one of the exhibits we're working on, is if you can imagine just the three-dimensional lake basin, Lake Tahoe Basin, and what we would put on it, say, would be like one layer at the surface, which would be that, and then you can bring in different layers at different depths, and you'll be able to add the particles you want. I mean, this is what we're aiming to do. I have a student who's working on it now. The results, to produce a month of data, takes many weeks, and so we're doing it for the summer period. Probably the next thing we'll do would be the winter period, and I'd be just as interested as you to find out how different it is. My experience in other lakes is that the biggest motions take place in summer. Winter, despite the big storms, things don't move as much.
Just a purely hypothetical, trivial thing, because it doesn't exist in nature. But, and what depth could you see a Secchi disk in pure, clean water?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good question. I think the number, and Charles, you may correct me, is about maybe 60 or 70 meters, so about 200 feet, 220 feet. Because light gets absorbed by the water itself, so you can have the purest water, and at 60 or 70 meters, the light would be extinguished. And then on top of that, you have particles, you have algae, you have dissolved material. So we always think of Crater Lake as being where we're trying to get to. And its clarity, on average, is pretty close to what we're aiming to, for about 31 meters. But as Dave Antonucci said, it has no watershed. So what's affecting its clarity is its atmospheric deposition, and that's it, and any change in the biology that may be occurring. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to say that when I got here in 58 and got out on the lake in early 59, we could see down 32 to 33 meters, and now we're right at about 22. So essentially, in a half century, we've lost a third of the transparency.
Okay, so actually, Dave Antonucci mentioned that those were the first clarity measurements ever taken at Tahoe. There were actually earlier measurements. So John LeConte, who our boat's named for, he was the first professor at the University of California. Actually, he was the only professor. He was one professor and the acting chancellor. And it was through him that this story about clarity is measured by lowering the dinner plate into the lake, because he preceded Seki, or he's a contemporary, but he used his wife's dinner plate. But his measurements were pretty much at around the same 32, 33 meters. He only did it for a couple of years. But
it was interesting, too, that Lacan had obviously read Farrell's monograph, Limnologie, on Lake Geneva, because that was the first limnological use of a Secchi disc. And actually, they had Warwick Vinson was able to dig up a correspondence between Farrell and Lacan. It's kind of historically interesting.
All right, so I want to stop us for a moment because Jeff will be here and Dr. Goldman will be here, and the public has been invited to join for Dr. Goldman's lecture. So we have 17 minutes for you all to make sure you get the food that you deserve before the rest of the people get here. So I want to make sure you get a chance because they're still setting it up now, so there will be a nice good time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think I have
Can I? I'd like to go through